making a clearer announcement about that, I think, on Sunday, after I get in touch with the lone techie who is still with Free Radio and see how that that can be done. And while I'm at it, an announcement about the December Street Spirit newspaper, for those of you who probably far or few and far between, but still around, who read that newspaper, which usually carries stories about Berkeley, San Francisco, Oakland, and sometimes other cities as well. It's a little bit shrunken and kind of special interest to some homeless. I don't want to necessarily call them poverty pimps. That may be unkind and unfair, but it doesn't have the breadth and the depth and the bulk that it had under previous editor Terry Messman. But you can still get it. You can still sell it if you're poor or homeless and you want to do that. You can find it by coming to the Huff meetings on Wednesday at 11 at the Sub Rosa, as mentioned before. That's at 703 Pacific next to the Bike Church. Or you can call me on the Huff phone line at 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF. Or the long number is 831-423-4833. And I'll get you copies one way or another. And sometimes we leave those copies actually kind of regularly at Food Not Bombs. I also try to, if I can, get copies of Street Sheet as well as Street Spirit. That's the Coalition on Homelessness's paper. Comes out twice a month in out of San Francisco's Coalition on Homelessness. It's still nitty-gritty, as it has always been throughout its 20 years, actually 30 years now, Street Spirit out in, from coming from the heart of the Tenderloin in San Francisco. And I occasionally am able to bring it down and make it available for distribution as well. You can write for Street Spirit or Street Sheet. I don't think you're going to get any money for it, but you might be able to pass on the word about what's going on in Santa Cruz to these two papers, and they may print what you do. So get in touch with me if you're interested in being a writer, 423-4833, or you can try to contact them directly, but I may be helpful in assisting you with that. And I'm not sure this is actually going to happen, because these things tend to pile up. Coming up next Tuesday is another shitty council meeting, or Santa Cruz City Council meeting, if you want to be accurate. They are likely to be swearing in their new members. They have two new members. One of them is a downtown association boss, and I don't really have a lot to say about the other one. I have not been terribly interested, but there are two new council members coming on, Sandy Brown and Watkins, the former mayor, will be returning as part of the very reactionary majority, at least in the part of Watkins, who sort of led the, dare I say, racist, classist city council meeting of last year, which dumped the only council members really interested in dealing with homeless issues. I suppose Sandy Brown is too, but it's a mixed bag for Sandy. She, I think she's, you might call her, from her perspective, pragmatic. From my perspective, well, she's lied to me, and she's broken her word, and I don't forgive that in a politician unless they make some attempt to acknowledge it, apologize for it, and stop doing it. And Sandy, at least in my case, has not done that. So I'm still hoping, well, I'm not hoping at all, but that's still an open option for her. And I've talked about it on past shows, and we'll talk about it again probably as time goes on. But Sandy's also done some good votes. She has to be given credit for that. But not for other things, which weigh pretty heavily on the ledger as I look at them. But in any case, the council meeting is coming up, and I wanted to review the detailed proposals that were rubber-stamped, it appeared to me, by Andy Mills, that were rubber-stamped by the council after being presented by the police chief Mills at the last city council, by actually having a discussion with, or at least reading some of the commentary of people who are critical of it, like Lee Brockow of the ACLU, John Malkin a former member of the Citizens Police Review Board and a part of a group trying to establish a more powerful Citizens Review Board many years ago. Not that I'm any fan of these Citizen Review Boards anymore, but at the time it was it seemed to many of us a meaningful step. If only it had gotten some teeth, and if the teeth it had gotten were actually been used to chomp down on police abuse, and neither things really happened. But I'm hoping I'll be able to give you at least a very brief look over about what the City Council has coming up on its agenda. That's behind closed doors, pretty much zooming along with public comment type time cut short by Mayor Justin Cummings, our very own Uncle Tom of Santa Cruz, who poses as someone who's concerned about police abuse and civil rights for poor people, which is, I guess he doesn't really pose that much. It's not really fair to say that. But some people so regard him, and that's probably because he's sort of the tattered remains of the progressive majority that we thought we had in 2018 before he deserted it very soon in January 2019 on the key issues of rent control and homelessness. So some listeners may remember interviews I've had with Santa Barbara writer and activist Peter Marin, who's kind of sort of stepped down. He's in his 80s now and trying to, probably do other things. He writes a lot of poetry about death and subjects of that sort, profound subjects. But he's also covers what's going on. And I think with some clarity and sharpness, when I can get him on the line, which sometimes takes a little doing, but it happens. And he has talked about a lawsuit that is now has been filed in Santa Barbara. It's the Committee for Social Justice, and then a number of other plaintiffs: Linda Trevino, Bradley Beach, Patricia West, Larry Carver, Richard Paluk, Alan Schwab, Arthur Lopez, Andrew Navarez, Thomas Goodwin, and Judy Atkins, none of whom I know, by the way, versus the City of Santa Barbara, the City of Santa Barbara Police Department, and the City of Santa Barbara Police Chief, Lori Lunau. Don't know her either. And Does 1 through 20. And here's a bit of this lawsuit as it reads. Introduction. In the midst of a severe housing crisis characterized by dramatically rising rents, shrinking affordable housing supply, long waits for housing subsidies, and a homeless population that has grown dramatically in the last 18 years, the City of Santa Barbara is targeting its most vulnerable residents, the homeless. There exist a large number of unsheltered homeless residents in Santa Barbara, many with disabilities, who seek shelter in recreational vehicles, RVs, or other vehicles. For these people, their vehicles are their only reliable, safe shelter from the elements and only place to store their belongings. Despite this, the city decided that those living in their RVs created a significant public nuisance due to sanitation, littering, excessive noise, placement by RV owners of personal belongings outside of RVs, and illegal dumping. Does this sound familiar, folks? These are some of the similar pretexts that have been used to drive away Alicia Kuhl and others from the spot where they were camping cleanly and safely along Olive Street off of Mission some months ago. In order to restrict RV parking, the lawsuit continues, the city adopted ordinances to restrict RV parking on certain streets and at certain time periods, eventually prohibiting RV parking completely on any street in Santa Barbara. And this was tried at night in Santa Cruz, which we were able to successfully fight by taking it to the Coastal Commission. It's not clear to me why this hasn't been done in Santa Barbara. It may have been explained to me one time or another, but I'm not sure what the explanation was. Maybe I can bring it up again and see what either Peter Marin or the person who's taking over that kind of work. And he's suggested some people that I could call attorneys who are doing this lawsuit, people with this Committee for Social Justice that he's been working with in Santa Barbara. So let's hope that happens in the future. This prohibition forced the homeless RV dwellers in Santa Barbara to park their RV in specific locations designated by the city for both day and night parking, or pay $48 for every offense parking on a city street. You have something similar happening in Santa Cruz with the Association of Faith Communities programs and other programs that call themselves safe parking programs, but at least for some RV people, are not safe at all. They aren't usable. They don't allow adequate access. They don't provide adequate support. I'm still trying to get sort of to the bottom of this in terms of claims and counterclaims, and some of them you probably have heard in the interviews I've done on the show. But if anybody wants to do research around the RV situation, I'm definitely interested in backing you up. I'm at 423-4833. Give me a call and we'll talk. Again, back to Santa Barbara. For RV dwellers living on a very limited disability or retirement income, payment of each $48 fine results in a severe reduction in available cash for living expenses such as food, gas, clothing, and vehicle insurance. And, of course, that's true in Santa Cruz, too. The city's pattern of passing ordinances targeting homeless RVs started on November 19, 2002, when the city adopted Ordinance 5263 to prohibit overnight parking from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. Now, in Santa Cruz, what we have instead of the parking prohibitions, we have sort of piecemeal prohibitions that have spread through so-called permit parking, which forces you to park for only 2 hours unless you get a permit, and you can't get a permit unless you are a brick-and-mortar resident. Alternately, people can't park in the city's public parking lots anymore at night. That's become illegal, even though those lots are empty, and there's no reason people shouldn't be parking there. You'll hear pretexts about, oh, sanitation, you know, where are they going to go poo? I've heard of such a thing as a porta potty or possibly opening some of the bathrooms at night. These obvious things, which became even more crucial with the COVID-19 crisis, they didn't entirely elude the city authorities. City authorities put in more porta potties suddenly, perhaps alarmed that people around town are going to get sick as a consequence of the failure to provide adequate sanitation for both visitors and homeless people outside, as well as residents who are, you know, abroad during the day or at night for one reason or another. And this is going to be a situation that grows more difficult and more severe, I think, as the COVID-19 surge increases. I mean, we have not just positive COVID tests increasing, which is significant, although people who are skeptical of the COVID crisis will tell you, well, look at how many people recovered. There's huge numbers of recovery, and the increase in the number of positive tests may be a function of people, more people getting tested, which is probably true to some extent. And the fact is, you know, there is a growing likelihood of a vaccine if you're a vaccine fan, although many people who are skeptical of the COVID-19 situation are also skeptical of vaccines. And I think we have had, I don't know if we have had many people recently on this. I'm still trying, but not very hard, to get together a debate with folks who are in this minority. It's a minority in Santa Cruz. I wouldn't call it a minority nationwide, though. I'd say there's a lot of people who voted for Trump more than last election. Yes, Trump got more votes, and he did better in almost every segment of the population except white men. It's kind of strange. In spite of the huge forces arrayed against him and his own mouth and behavior arrayed against him. So, back to the RVs. In Santa Barbara, that same year, the city amended the zoning ordinance, that's in 2002, to allow the use of the RV as overnight accommodations in certain non-residential zones of the city. Thereafter, Santa Barbara residents sued the city over the 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. parking ordinance. That suit was resolved with an agreement by the city to amend its overnight parking ordinance by making it applicable only in a defined area of the city's waterfront. So they limited it. And in fact, what we won the right to RVs at night in those areas which are not not only do they give you only 2 hours during the day, but you can't actually be there at all at night in many permit parking noticed areas, not because other people need the spaces, but because of this just straight bigotry and apprehension against homeless folks. That's really what it is. And it's also partially as greed, has to do with property values. It has to do, I think, with, I don't know, a growing defensiveness toward and a kind of xenophobia toward people who are different, and particularly people who are poor. I guess you call it a classist kind of fear. Do I have scientific evidence of this? No, I do not. But I think it is, well, it's my supposition, and it's sort of my conclusion from looking over what I've seen. Anyway, back in Santa Barbara in November 2008, the Public Works and Police Departments approached the City Ordinance Committee with a new RV parking ordinance, citing increased and significant public nuisance problems associated with RVs, such as lack of proper sanitation or fire safety, littering, excessive noise, placement of RV owners of personal belongings outside RVs, and illegal dumping. Now, here in Santa Cruz, of course, usually the anti-homeless ordinances that are brought forward for us don't have any documentation from the police department or the public works or the parks and rec. And just get a bunch of people from Take Back Santa Cruz to start shaking needles at the city council and ranting about that. Or you get people who claim to be very concerned about homeless civil rights issues or homeless service issues, but say they just need people somewhere else, but not in their neighborhood. This defeated the Depot Park camping area, and was led by Rafa Sonnenfeld, who you've heard on the show, who then became a part of the CATCH committee, which is the catch-all sort of little rubber stamp that the city council created. Or it's more of like a trash can to send homeless stuff to, rather than act on any of the stuff that had been presented by city council members in the progressive side of the aisle last year. They simply said, oh, well, we'll send it for research to the CATCH committee, go out and talk among the community and so forth. And while I'm a big fan of public discussion on issues, there are other times when public discussion becomes a way of avoiding acting in a crisis, which is what we have had for a long time on this issue. And then, of course, when the crisis became even more severe with the COVID-19 situation, immediately campgrounds were set up. Not many of them, not enough of them, not in any fiscally responsible way for the majority of homeless people, not ones that also gave options for the disabled and the elderly and those who really need them to go into single occupancy motel rooms, which are really the only safer way to deal with the extreme transmissibility of the COVID-19 situation, however serious you think it is, one way or the other. And, I mean, some people did get into those hotels, but not a majority, and not people, those who were requested. Many people are still asking for it. One guy came to the Huff meeting yesterday who has been trying to get in for 6 months after volunteering at the Association of Faith Communities. He's still on the waiting list. So you have all these empty motel rooms, and you have all kinds of homeless people camped outside. The rains are coming, the surge is rising, and the city council is doing nothing. The county has set up one campground, and people are being, at the moment, allowed to be in San Lorenzo Park, but there are only, it's either two or three porta-potties. The bathrooms are closed, there's no potable water, and it's a situation of well, it's a disgraceful situation, for sure. Continuing with Santa Barbara, and I have to keep coming back to Santa Cruz, that's where we live. In December 2008, the city adopted a new ordinance restricting excessive numbers of RV parking within 500 feet of at least one of the following land uses: any school or education institution, any child care center, family daycare center, or group home, any park, public library, museum open to the public, any community center or social center, public or private, any city or nonprofit recreational facility, any community care facility, skilled nursing facility, health care facility or hospital, any homeless shelter, any church or other religious facility. The city defined excessive as a single RV. And it's hard to read all this with a straight face, but yeah, that's what the lawsuit says, and I'm presuming that's accurate, though I haven't, of course, double-checked it. Over time, in response to public complaints, the city added locations where RV parking was prohibited under the excessive RV ordinance. At some locations, even one RV was considered excessive. The public complaints by persons living in residential areas concerned the nuisance and safety concerns posed by long-term RV parking adjacent to their stationary homes. These concerns included problems with litter, sewage disposal, and noise. Again, we're talking complaints. And again, I haven't checked out in Santa Barbara any sense of the validity or verifiability of those complaints. Since December 16, 2016, the city has used Ordinance Number 5781, which prohibits oversized vehicles longer than 25 feet or wider than 80 inches or taller than 82 inches from parking on any streets or portions of streets where the public works director has caused signs or markings giving adequate notice of restriction to repeatedly ticket and harass those individuals seeking shelter in their vehicles or simply owning a vehicle and having nowhere to park. Under the California Vehicle Code, vehicles may be up to 102 inches wide, 14 feet high, and 40 feet in length. By further restricting and conflicting with the California Vehicle Code, the city is violating the constitutional rights, specifically equal protection of the law of plaintiffs. And, of course, that's something they did in Berkeley. And I think I haven't heard it being proposed yet in Santa Cruz, except here they are using things like reducing the size of parking spaces to stop people and forbidding people from using more than one parking space to stop people from parking large vehicles, which usually is a way of going after poor people and their vehicles. The city is using this ordinance in Santa Barbara to target homeless vehicle owners, ticketing them and impounding the vehicles for unpaid tickets. And, of course, this is happening here. We heard about that from Dread Eye. You may remember an individual who talked about this. And it happened with Ben. These are activists who I've talked about in the past, as well as other folks, too, whose names do not come to mind. The city is aware of the rights of, this is in Santa Barbara, the city is aware of the rights of low-income RV dwellers and disabled persons and the impact this ordinance has upon them, but has elected to ignore those consequences. As further described herein, the city has intentionally discriminated against and infringed upon the constitutional rights of both RV dwellers and disabled people. The city carried out this discriminatory, cruel, punitive, and unconstitutional policy against homeless vehicle dwellers, many of whom have disabilities, despite the fact that these individuals have nowhere else to go. Sky-high rents and extremely low incomes, among other conditions, have excluded these city residents from the housing market. RV parks are often as costly as renting an apartment and thus are not a viable option. The safe parking program discussed below does not have enough spaces for RV dwellers, as evidenced by the city's ongoing search for additional safe parking spaces. The city has established safe parking locations for RV dwellers to park at night and in the daytime, but the number of daytime locations are limited because they are used for other purposes. Safe parking locations require RV dwellers to give up their constitutional rights to park in safe parking locations. Thus, RV dwellers are faced with two options. One, pay $48 parking tickets for each time they park on a city street, or two, forfeit their constitutional rights so they can park in a designated safe parking location if there are available spots. And that's a similar situation here in Santa Cruz, at least in terms of you don't get a $48 ticket for parking your vehicle if you can find a place to do it, but you may soon get harassment by, well, it may be Joe Havey, it may be Deb Elston, it may be anybody else of Mills' group of ticketeers who hit the roads with green stickers, mark your tires, and then, without necessarily any evidence, can ticket you and then tow your vehicle eventually when the tickets start mounting up. If you're there, they claim beyond 72 hours. And we've talked about this before. We've actually gone to the police chief, folks from Huff, folks from the Santa Cruz Homeless Coalition and Food Not Bombs, to point out how A, counterproductive this is, and to ask that Chief Mills make it really clear to homeless residents that they cannot make false reports about vehicles being in their neighborhood without suffering a consequence, that a false report is a misdemeanor crime. And I so far, however, not heard of a police department accepting one complaint from a person in a vehicle saying that they've gotten there were been falsely reported. I think that's, by the way, a very good thing to do. If you find people are falsely reporting you, call the police and make a complaint. You're not going to get anywhere with a complaint, but you will establish a record that you have attempted to do so. You might say, well, won't this make you a target? And yes, it might, but you're apparently already a target is the problem based upon the fact that you're getting false complaints about your RV coming down on you. Plaintiffs used to be able to park their vehicles in Santa Barbara at the waterfront parking lots all day by paying a $100 annual fee. But on October 8, 2019, Santa Barbara City Council approved various amendments to the Santa Barbara Municipal Code Chapter 17 pertaining to waterfront parking regulations. The amendments included denying annual parking to vehicles 22 feet long or 90 inches high or 82 inches wide. Those vehicles whose size exceeds the new size regulations, including recreational vehicles, motorhomes, house cars, and campers will still be able to use the waterfront parking lots, but we are required to pay hourly daily rates. Plaintiffs have limited income and cannot afford to pay hourly or daily rates. Santa Barbara Municipal Code 10.440-2220 violates numerous state constitutional rights, including the Eighth Amendment prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment and the 14th Amendment due process protections, including the prohibition on state-created danger, the right to equal protection, the right to travel, and the right to associate. This is a complaint for money damages, declaratory and injunctive relief by plaintiffs, some of whom are disabled, many of whom are retired, and all of whom are longtime or native residents of Santa Barbara. Plaintiffs do not have fixed residences and therefore use residential vehicles as their primary residence as an alternative to being homeless and living on the streets. Plaintiffs seek redress for injuries caused as a result of the City of Santa Barbara's well-known, long-running policy of targeting people without fixed dwellings, homeless, such as plaintiffs, in an effort to force homeless people out of Santa Barbara to preserve Santa Barbara's status as, quote, one of the leading tourist destinations in the United States, one of the top 125 cities in the USA, and playground for the rich and famous. Specifically here, plaintiffs seek redress for injuries caused by the enactment and enforcement of Santa Barbara Municipal Code 10.44.220 on the grounds that it is targeted against RV dwellers, such as plaintiffs without justifications, and prohibits plaintiffs from parking their vehicles on public streets, and therefore is unconstitutional and in violation of well-established state constitutional rights, statutes, and case laws, including the Vehicle Code, the Equal Protection Clause, and the right to travel. Let's take a musical break.
I'm a free-born man of the traveling people. Got no fixed abode, with nomad's eye and numbered. Country lanes and byways were always my ways. I've never fancied being lumbered. Places. And the small bird sang when winter time was over. Then we'd pack our load and be on the road. They were good old times for the rover. In the open ground you could stop and linger for a week or two, for time was not your master. Then away you'd jog with your horse and the dog. Nice and easy, no need to go fast.
us other people. Hear the news or else swap family information. At the country fairs we'd be meeting there, all the people of the traveling nation. I've made willow creels and the heather besoms, and I've even done some begging and some hawking, and I've lain this bench wrapped up in my tent, and I've listened to the old folks talking. Traveling people, every tinker, rolling stone, and gypsy rover, winds of change are blowing, old ways are going. Your traveling days will soon be over. I'm a freeborn man of the traveling people, got no fixed abode, with nomads I am numbered. Country lanes and byways were always my ways. I've never fancied being lumbered.
And that was The Traveling People by the Dubliners, originally created by Ewan McCall and sung by him and Peggy Seeger and Charlie Parker back in 1964. And I found the lyrics a little hard to hear, so I'm going to read them. I'm a freeborn man of the traveling people, got no fixed abode, with nomads I am numbered. Country lanes and byways were always my ways. I never fancied being lumbered. Well, we knew the woods and all the resting places. The small birds sang when winter time was over. Then we'd pack our load and be on the road. They were good old times for the rover. In the open ground where a man could linger, stay a week or two, for time was not your master. Then away you'd jog with your horse and dog, and nice and easy, no need to go faster. And sometimes you'd meet up with other travelers, hear the news, or else swap family information. At the country fairs, we'd be meeting there all the people of the traveling nation. I've made willow creels and heather besoms, and even done some begging and some hawking, and I've lain there spent, wrapped up in my tent, and I've listened to the old folks talking. All you freeborn men of the traveling people, every tinker, rolling stone, and gypsy rover, winds of change are blowing, old ways are going, your traveling days will soon be over. So I often get emails from Julie Shaw, who's a mom who's lives, I believe she's in a vehicle, at least part of the time, and she keeps an eye on, well, I guess you might say she's protective of her own family and those in other vehicles and homeless people generally. She sends me occasional reports about what's going on. Recently, I got this. Harassment at Safeway Parish Pub parking lot, West Side. Today I ordered lunch from Safeway on Almar, and I overheard a customer confronting the Abbott SBI Inc. security guard for harassing him as the customer ate his Panda Express in his car. There, as I was eating lunch in my car with my family, this woman sits at a sidewalk table in front of my car and stares menacingly at my family and me. And then I took a picture of my family and I, and she called the Abbott SBI Inc. security guard on me too. When I asked the security guard his name, he walked away. I recognized the woman as being a regular at the parish. I've also seen her screaming and running after a car at the Costco parking lot. Eric and Sarah at the parish are aware of the situation. Has anybody else had similar issues with harassment at these locations? And she continues, illegal censorship, even discussing the typical Nextdoor.com bias and prejudice against persons experiencing homelessness on other social media venues, and not even showing screenshots, mentioning names, or any private information, by the way, can get someone booted from Nextdoor.com just because they don't agree. And this was something I heard from one of the neighbors to Deb Elston, who was talking with me about his concerns about, he had mixed feelings about Deb Elston. He felt that she did some good things in organizing the Santa Cruz neighbors, but she didn't, the next door was not such a hot, he didn't get well treated there, and he felt there was a form of censorship involved. That's what I understood from him. And this is the kind of complaint I've heard a number of times. And, of course, censorship is kind of becoming all the rage as lefties start shouting about, let's shut down the hate speech of the Nazis, but that, of course, will be used to shut down other people's speech, too. It usually begins going after people on the left or on the extreme right, and then goes after anybody that the people in the center don't like and don't want to even challenge their superiority, by terms of their position of power. Which is how you see, for example, the electoral system set up, so that third parties just have no option to get in there. And even reform movements in the main parties, like Bernie Sanders, don't have a chance. Although Trump seemed to do pretty well, taking over the Republicans, if you call that reform. I suppose it's a form of an attack on some of the institutional structure, both in the country and in the Republican Party. But it's, generally speaking, not the kind of reform that I'm interested in. And it also is a form of demagoguery which doesn't really carry out the promises that were made. Some of them he attempts to carry out. But mostly it's personal aggrandizement. So in earlier shows, I've talked about the death of Tamario Smith, covered some of the protests around that. He's a guy who died in jail, allegedly from drinking too much water. And I speak with some skepticism, though in theory that has happened to some few people. But I spoke with, I emailed John Malkin, who's an activist concerned with police misconduct. And I'm hoping actually we can get him to look into, as I said before, and talk about, or maybe I can read some of his commentary on the Mills cosmetic reforms around the police that Justin Cummings is sort of presenting as some kind of meaningful outcome to a public process when it's not. But what Malkin did was he also did some interviewing of the attorneys who are covering the Tamario Smith death. And I'm going to play a little of that now, though you can find it more on Santa Cruz Indie Media if you want to hear more of it, which I suggest you might want to do. But let's hear a little of it here and now. So this is an interview with Jonathan Gettleman and Elizabeth Caballero. The two Santa Cruz attorneys who are filing a civil rights lawsuit on behalf of Smith's family. On May 10th, 2020, 21-year-old Tamario Smith died in Santa Cruz County, California County Jail. According to the county sheriff, Smith died of overconsumption of water, as I mentioned. And here's a little of that discussion. This was originally played on KZSC back in September, and then there was a protest in June about it at the town clock with posters put up, what happened to Tamario Smith? And I haven't heard any follow-up on this. You go online, you can see there's currently a story at indiebay.org/Santa Cruz if you want to look it up.
Please note that the opinions expressed by the two attorneys during this interview regarding a variety of legal and political issues are their own and do not necessarily reflect the beliefs of the Smith family. I want to hear from the two of you about this movement to defund the police or abolish the police, which partly means replacing the police with something, systems that actually serve the health and safety and well-being needs of our communities rather than training people to shoot at us and use coercion and control and quite often torture and other means, putting people in cages. May I love to hear from both of you kind of broadly about that, but maybe start specifically with this 21-year-old person, Tamario Smith, who died in the Santa Cruz County Jail on May 10th. Would you just start off by explaining your understanding of what happened to Tamario at the Santa Cruz County Jail?
That's a lot to unpack, John. that's a big question, and I think it would help your listeners and potential readers if we broke it down a little bit. So we can we were just discussing the whole nomenclature of defund the police, and I was just commenting about how I really dislike that term. I think it's completely unhelpful to the movement. And I think a better way to think about it is refund our communities. We all, I think, understand that police departments and cities allocate a tremendous, an almost obscene amount of our tax dollars towards agencies that are not out to help us, but in fact oftentimes inflict the most harm on us. Physically, with abusive arrest tactics, also with the outright separation of families. When people get arrested, what happens to their children? When people get sentenced to prison, who takes care of their kids? I mean, this is a common tactic that is done to demoralize a group of people, is separate them from their children. And we're realizing the harm that that creates, not just entire generations of kids who grow up parentless and in foster care and in foster homes, but you have entire systems put in place to sort of re-inflict the harm on these kids instead of investing in our most precious resource, which is our kids. So we think that what we need to do is start investing in our communities, starting with schools, starting with aftercare programs for children, starting with teenagers, diverting them from the juvenile justice system, starting with young adults, instead of penalizing them with criminal convictions that make it incredibly challenging to get jobs, having a circle justice, you know, where we talk about the issue and instead of punishing them, you know, trying to work in a system of rewards to encourage good behavior. So I think that needs to change. The defund the police statement is not helpful. Now I'll let Jonathan address Tamario's case specifically.
Yeah, I would just follow up with what Elizabeth's saying, and I think defunding the police is the kind of language that is used by policing agencies that don't want to be defunded to make it sound extreme, and I don't think that's helpful. What we really need to do is reallocate our priorities, and our priorities are basically how we spend money in a society, because money is essentially the commerce of energy. So one of the big things, and I'll get to Tamario in a second, but one of the big things I need to mention, and I keep harping on it because I think it's important, is that there is a kind of slavery that is perfectly permitted in this country, and it is enshrined in the 13th Amendment, and that is that all slavery is abolished by the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution unless upon conviction by a court of jurisdiction, meaning that if you are quote-unquote convicted, then you are permitted legally by the Constitution, which is our most powerful statute in this country, our guiding principles. You are allowed to be enslaved. You are allowed to be forced to work for no pay. And institutions that relied on slavery have throughout the history of the United States leaned heavily into that clause of the 13th Amendment, such that in the South and other cities, when it was time to pick cotton, then vagrancy laws would be heavily enforced. Vagrancy laws are very relevant to the way policing is done in Santa Cruz, because all homeless people prior to the you know, well, through the sleeping ban, are illegal. It's illegal to be homeless, and you can be arrested for being homeless. And so all I'm saying that to say is that these are institutions that support a form of slavery that is overt. It is written into the 13th Amendment. And so this whole process of how we spend our resources, this pipeline of public schools, underfunded public schools pipeline to prison, is real. And in some ways, county jails are part of that pipeline. Thank you for giving me that moment of excursion into the, you know, the unique history of our country and how it has evolved from its origins. Tamario Smith was a 21-year-old young man who had a lot of issues. He was in a car accident. He was really badly injured. He eventually, and not saying it's from a car accident, but he developed schizophrenia. He was terribly disabled. He had voices that would inform him of things that he should or shouldn't do. And he was so disabled that he was found to be unable to even participate in his own trial, such that he was just going to be sent to a state facility until some time in the future when he was able to participate in his trial. He had some challenges with substances, as a lot of people do that have mental health issues. And he had challenges with his partner, who was a lot older than him, and, you know, would kind of get tired of Mario and call the police on him, which is how, you know, which is how he came into this situation. He was accused of domestic violence. It was a case that was, as a lot of cases are, terribly overcharged in terms of what had happened. And he is waiting in custody. However, the Santa Cruz County Jail has outsourced all of their health care to various corporations. The first corporation was CFMG. In multiple grand jury reports in Santa Cruz, CFMG was found to be incredibly delinquent. I don't think people realize the tragedy that is going on in our local jail, but compared to other jails per capita of population, ours has one of the, and at one point, the most deaths in California of any county. So CFMG, they are the lowest bidder and expect the lowest amount of service out of the lowest bidder. CFMG has now been incorporated into a company called WellPath. WellPath is the largest national provider of prison jail health care. They're equally atrocious. So Tamario Smith was essentially receiving no health care whatsoever. And he was housed in a jail cell as a schizophrenic person who has hallucinations 20 hours a day in his cell alone. A normal person, the UN Commission on Human Rights has established that solitary confinement is torture and it causes mental derangement in normal people. You can only imagine what it would cause in the mind of a 21-year-old schizophrenic. 20 hours a day alone in his cell. And he is only allowed out of his cell between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. for whatever happens during that time that they essentially allow people out on their pods. You know, the nurses come along to just feed him medication, and that's about it. When they do safety checks in the jail, it's not like prison where they have people come to the door themselves of their cells for count. They don't go into the rooms. They look in the window, and sometimes they don't look in the window because these are steel doors that have these tiny windows. Sometimes the windows are covered up. So what do? They take their electronic card and they swipe it across a scanner like you would a credit card, and they just keep walking, and that's considered a check. In addition, it is well known, and it's been well known for a long time, that the safety emergency buttons inside the cells are completely non-functional in the jail. This has been going on for years. This has been the subject of lawsuits. For some reason, they just will not address this issue. So Mario Smith died in a position that was clear to the person across the cell from him that he was trying to push that emergency button and couldn't. In addition, Mario Smith died, apparently, according to the coroner's office, although it's not completely clear based on their investigation, of overconsumption of water, because they told him that he needed to drink at least 5 glasses of water because they thought he was dehydrated. So he died of listening to them because there was insufficient care taken as to what was actually going on with him. Mr. Smith also had terrible kidney problem. It was well documented in his medical records. That creates an issue with your sodium levels in your blood because you're not, your blood's not being cleaned and regulated appropriately. And that also probably played into how he died. In addition, it seems like he drank cleaning fluid out of the bucket, the mop bucket, pink cleaning fluid, to try to clean his body out, because in his mental state of whatever he was thinking, he thought that was a good idea. And although people on his cell block dissuaded him from doing that,
To interject quickly, there has been some evidence that Tamario was potentially actually or thinking about drinking cleaning fluid to help prevent the coronavirus.
And they found a bottle, a drinking bottle of cleaning fluid from the mop bucket in his room, and he had, you know, thrown up various places. In other words,
nobody is watching these inmates. Nobody is actually, it's a total dereliction of duty.
Yeah, and not only that, and that's a really good point, but they are just being ignored to death, literally to death. We have another client who died in the Santa Cruz County Jail after his roommates, who are gang members, and he was not, killed him. And they did not find him for 24 to 30 hours in his own bed. Dead. You know, asphyxiated, hung and stabbed. And he was post-rigor mortis. And I'm sorry to be graphic, but that means that his body was not even rigid anymore. It had gone through that cycle. And he was decomposing in his cell. It is well beyond a level of neglect that is happening. And this is all while these people, some of them with serious mental health problems, are in the, and this is really important language, John, they're in the custody and care of the sheriff's department, because the gentleman who was killed by the young gentleman who was killed by his cellmate, he was awaiting trial for 6 years. From the time he was 17 years old, a minor, he was waiting for trial for 6 years and didn't have a trial and was killed. Probably because they felt that he was the weakest link in the chain of who might tell. Mario Smith, he might have never gotten a trial. He could have just been in indefinite custody in a mental health hospital. So there are many systematic issues, and we can also talk about, you know, policing on the street as well. But this issue with Tamario Smith, because we still don't know. I mean, with all the evidence that he drank this fluid, they never tested the contents of his stomach to see if there was fluid in it. But the coroner works for the sheriff's department.
A disturbing component of that case is that the coroner reviewed the video from the pod that Tamario was in and notably observed that he took this fluid from the mop bucket back to his room. And she just observed one day, or at least that's what's reflected in her report. There was no systemic follow-up of like, gee, let's take a look at the entire time he was in custody. Was this something he was engaging in? It was a known discussion point amongst other people in the pod that he had heard about this as a potential coronavirus cure. Other inmates said, you don't want to drink cleaning fluid. It's poison. It's very bad for you. But it leads us to ask the question, who is watching the videos? I mean, they're recording all this tape, and supposedly the videos are there to assist security of the facility, but oftentimes it's just playing to some ghost. I mean, they're not observing. They're not using the video to be at all helpful to ensuring the security and care of their charges.
Especially people that are innocent. I mean, every single one of these people that we're talking about is awaiting a trial. That means that they are presumed innocent. So they are not just people, and I'm not even saying that it should be worse for people that are in prison and inmates, but those people are at least have been convicted of something. But the people we're talking about are just accused and can't get out of jail because they can't make bail or because they have a probation detainer, which means that they have probation on another case, and so they are being detained in the jail by the probation department while, you know, this new case comes out.
And that's the first 15 minutes of an hour-long interview by John Malkin with attorneys Gettleman and Caballero in a story headed to Mario Smith's death in Santa Cruz County Jail. Attorneys discuss May 10th death and lawsuit. Check it out if you want. It's an audio file you can download and listen to if you have that capability. I may play more of it on Sunday's show, but it's available to you now if you want to listen to it directly. So up next is a song by the Parody Project, written and performed by Don Carone, called The Voter Fraud Fraud. And because some of the lyrics may not be audible, though this actually sounds pretty audible, here's what you're going to get. The right wing did its peeps maraud with frail conspiracies of fraud, of zombies from the grave who clawed their way to vote that day. More votes than voters was their claim. Vote dumps and fake results they blamed. Machines that switched the voted's name and caused their loss, they say. So now they're trapped in lies they weave. They need their voters to believe their vote will count in Georgia's race. That is the challenge which they face. For weeks they've blasted us with news of China, Cuba, and of Hugo Chavez, and a soft war ruse that all came into play. Now they need an about-face, or they will lose in Georgia's race. They've killed the hopes of their own base by all that they inveigh. Why should we vote? The fix is in, they cry. You told us where and when. You told us of a great cabal. There's no recourse for us at all. Has karma ever been so clean, so many lessons you could glean as you watch their lie machine fall into disarray? Republicans are slow to learn the consequences that they earn by pushing lies at every turn to steal the vote away. They try to switch the narrative from widespread fraud imperative to suddenly it's all okay to vote Georgia's election day. Meanwhile, Trump tries to convince his voting base of his pretense, and the courts dismiss it as nonsense. His grift has had its day. His scam needs little to survive. An enemy will make it thrive. So enemies he will contrive when things don't go his way. He just threw Kemp under the bus and Raffensperger's superfluous. And he doesn't care who takes the fall. He's all about himself. That's all. It all sets one a-ponderin' where did their minds go wanderin' when they stayed silent while their leader tried to stage a coup. They built a monster from thin air. Where'er they go, it will be there. Lack of trust and deep despair will stick to them like glue. They might think they can reconstruct. I'm here to tell them they are fucked, and the orange will very soon be plucked from Pennsylvania Avenue. And, of course, a couple of notes to this. The Democrats do something similar with their prima facie voting restrictions, their gerrymandering, and their own tricks to exclude third parties and Republicans if they can. those who think there's fraudulent elections are, in fact, urging people not to vote in Georgia, although some Republicans, of course, want them to vote, so they will vote in the Republican majority. But there are some people who sincerely believe that there is massive voter fraud. I'm not one of them, except to believe that the entire system of American voting is fraudulent in the sense that you're getting a choice between pre-selected candidates who essentially are running for different positions in the same corporation, which has nothing to do with what the people really need or want. They're given this phony choice of this circus every 2 years or every 4 years for the presidential race. But anyway, here's the song, so enjoy.
The right wing did its peeps maraud with frail conspiracies of fraud, of zombies from the grave who clawed their way to vote that day. More votes than voters was their claim. Both dumps and fake results they blame. The machines that switched the voted's name, it caused their loss, they say. So now they're trapped in lies they weave. They need their voters to believe their vote will count in Georgia's race. That is the challenge that they face. They blasted us with news of China, Cuba, and of Hugo Chavez and the software ruse that all came into play. And now they ain't even about face, or they were losing Georgia's race. They killed the hopes of their own base by all that they invade. Why should we vote? The fix is in. They cried, you told us where and when. You told us of a great cabal. There's no recourse for us at all. Karma ever been so clean, so many lessons you could glean as you watch their lie machine fall into disarray. Republicans are slow to learn the consequences that they earn by pushing lies at every turn to steal the vote away. They tried to switch the narrative from widespread fraud imperative to suddenly it's all okay to vote Georgia's election day. Meanwhile, Trump tries to convince his voting base of his pretense. The courts dismiss it as nonsense. His grift has had its day. His scam needs little to survive. An enemy will make it thrive. So enemies he will contrive when things don't go his way. He just threw Kemp under the bus and Ravensburger superfluous. And he don't care who takes the fall. He's all about himself, that's all. It all sets one up pondering, where did their minds go wandering, when they stayed silent while their leader tried to stage a coup. They built a monster from thin air, where'er they go it will be there. A lack of trust and deep despair will stick to them like glue. They might think they can reconstruct, I'm here to tell them they're f***ed, and the orange will very soon be plucked from Pennsylvania Avenue.
So we're talking with...
This is Cooper.
Cooper, you bring news. Have you been watching... you actually have a TV hookup out there?
No, this... I was over at my friend's, and she informed me that on The Price is Right, the prize was an all-expense-paid trip to Santa Cruz to stay at the Paradox.
Did you apply for that particular...
No, we laughed. Come to the war zone. It's funny because the back of the Paradox looks straight down onto the whole camp, and there's probably like 120 tents now on the top lawn of San Lorenzo Park.
Have you actually counted them recently?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I think all of our revolutions started in a park. It's kind of interesting.
Now, does this mean that there are also, of course, 15 or 20 porta-potties have been added to these?
No. When the city backed out from helping the people with the bench lands, they took the water, the garbage cans, and they took the porta-potties. And a lot of those same people are still in the vicinity. They're just up on top. We still have the same three that are also for the public who come through the park. So hundreds and hundreds of people and three porta potties.
And I take it no one is Well, I don't know. Are people using the county buildings facilities?
I don't think people want to go in there. They have an aversion to the courthouse.
When we last spoke, you told me that they were putting up a new fence and they'd given some warnings to people to move on or else.
Right. People have been there for a few months, homesteaded there along the side by the lawn bowling. Then they were served with eviction notice and threats to be arrested. But nobody came back, as we had some liaisons that contacted the sheriff in charge, Hart, and again brought up the Boise versus Martin ruling that they're not to move people. They have no other homestead area for people to move. They're not to disrupt and especially to threaten with incarceration, fines, ticketing, and we will take your things. So they did not come back to move the people from that side. However, some of the people moved anyway, and it was a move up for them because they were able to move on soft grass instead of the county. Over in that county area that has been not well maintained at all, and there's bumpy gopher holes everywhere. It's not ideal. So a lot of people, it was a move up, and they did move. Some people didn't, and then we were able to put more campers on that little hill there.
The last time I was there, we talked about, I guess, 40 to 50 tents for about 100 people. Now you say there's 100 tents?
I think I counted like 116. And so I'm assuming there's probably, you know, give or take a few more. Some of the tents have several people. Some of them have one. Some of them have none. Some of them are stores. So, but there's a couple hundred people. And it's great because really everybody's knows each other out there for the most part. Everybody's been getting along for the most part. And it's divine.
Are you getting much help from harm reduction people?
There are a few groups have been coming with all kinds of, you know, first aid supplies and usable items, blankets and hand warmers and flashlights and hot chocolate. And that's what I've seen lately, so that makes me happy.
The last time that happened?
What, 3 or 4 days ago that they came out? And the hand warmers really help because it really gets cold at night. And there are still a lot of people with no tents. And anyway.
A lot of people with no tents are in that area.
Yeah, I mean, people come to us all the time. That are in need of a tent. But for the most part, everybody has upgraded. Everybody's tents are really quite nice, and they have room. A lot of them have room to stand up. And I think, like I told you last time, people seem to be getting healthier, you know, where they're able to rest and eat and have community that cares. And there's real healing in that.
People kind of what, just walk in their water?
No, we actually got some big water containers. And we got some big water containers so that we are not going through so many water bottles. You know, because we were kind of relying on good Samaritans to bring us water because there's no water on the fields. There's no electricity and no water for over 200 people. And so we've had a lot of good Samaritans come and bring water. But to cut down on the garbage of all the bottles, and we got a couple of big tank, you know, the big blues, and you could take it down to New Leaf and fill the whole thing for like $3. And people can refill their water bottles.
How's the scene at, for people who want to sleep at night? Is it pretty quiet? Is it pretty loud?
Yeah, my area over where on my side's really quite quiet. We're like a number line. If you want quiet, you come down on my side. And the rowdy crew's down the other side. They're great. They're the rough boys, and I love them. They can't have everybody sleeping all night long, or we would be, you know, our camp wouldn't be as safe as it is. But half the crew is awake all night long, and it's kind of protective.
And Adetta, you are another resident of the camp?
I come by there and hang out there. I sleep in my car. But doing the best I can. I've got a bunch of tickets now I've got to somehow take care of that I got while I was in jail, so I'd like to see if I could have them thrown out. I'm going to go tomorrow to see what I can do about that. I'm trying to get some more money out of my SSI account because I have to go pay my phone bill and my insurance and my bondsman. And then I'm going to be broke. I'm going to be broke before that gets done.
Well, I know when we spoke last, actually, maybe it was the time before last, you were telling me we tried to get you your property out of police impound.
I got it.
And today would have been the day, right?
Today was the day I got it, but I would really like a GoFundMe because I'm in desperate need of money, and I'm trying to help and feed people and clothe people, but it's really kind of hard when I've got tickets for no reason. The police attacked me one day. They say I attacked them. I did not attack the police at all or anybody else. I'm not about attacking anybody. And this is ridiculous that they attacked me and put me in jail. And I'm almost speechless because...
They put him in for resisting arrest, but there was no arrestable offense or ticket written or anything. They grabbed him. And yep. Then when he doesn't want to be kidnapped, then they call it resisting arrest. And
were you a witness to Greta?
We noticed he was gone after we hadn't seen him for a day. And so we did our checking up. And when his car was still there, I knew that he was ambushed by the police in the park.
How long after Greta was taken was his car, should we say, protected or the valuable property removed into a safe place?
It was protected the whole time. It was never moved, towed, anything.
No, and it's took valuable stuff out of my car for
right,
me. Yes.
You know, friends, but he was, you know, friends took things just in case they towed it.
Anything you want to conclude with, Cooper, as you light up? I don't know if this is a no-smoking zone, but I'm not going to tell.
I was supposed to be a joker, a smoker, and a midnight toker. Know your role. That's it.
Greta, any final thoughts?
I'm still planning.
I need some help to get my tickets taken care of, to try and not take my vehicle from me, which is my house. And I haven't done anything wrong to where they should even stop me. I don't speed. I don't deal hard drugs. I don't steal. All I do is help feed and clothe people. I'm sorry I had the confrontation with the police. I hope me and them get along much better in the future. I don't want to fight them or anyone else.
Thank you.
If you could put that in the air, that'd be great.
We will.
Things are good.
So,
lots of food, everybody get fed.
Talking with
Matt, Ernesto,
Steven.
How long have you three guys been here today?
I've been here for like 2 hours?
Yeah,
about 2 hours.
I've been here for like an hour.
Yeah, I think I've also been here for maybe an hour.
So you got shifts that you do this, so to speak?
Yeah, I try to come here every day after work.
You were relieving someone who was here before?
Not so much. I was just adding another hand. A lot of the time.
And these are three guys serving food at the Daily Food Not Bombs meal, which really is the only regular daily meal in town. I mean, you can find different meals at different places at different times, and that's true. But this is the only one you can regularly go to, and also where you can actually... you can sit down, have some kind of company and companionship with other people. And sometimes that involves social distancing, and sometimes it doesn't. But they are, of course, they encourage people to wear masks. They encourage people to socially distance.
We just come back and do work at our own discretion.
We're talking beyond 1 to 4. What, 1 to 5 every day?
Actually, it's 12 to 5 every day. We usually start packing up around 4, though. It's probably.
And what delicacies have been on the menu today?
Some really good-looking bread pudding and some pea soup, too. It's been really warm.
Rice?
Rice.
Always rice, yeah. I got to have the carbs.
Now, what about the tasty lettuce?
Oh, man. Ran out of that pretty quick, though. Yeah.
We also have lots of great bread from Companion. Always good.
No exotic fruits and vegetables?
Oh, hey, maybe in my wildest dreams and fantasies.
Not today. Just lentils.
I just saw these.
Any reports of how police are treating people outside that you've received?
I'm sorry?
How are police treating campers that here in the area?
I mean, you can expect pigs to be pigs. As far as I know,
No problem.
There haven't been any major incidents, but we all know that the pigs are looking to pull a jack move on anybody out here sleeping in the street. So by no means is it safe for folks, but we also can't report any major incidents as of late.
Well, we don't have any sense.
Have you heard anything in the last couple of days that would cause you any concern?
There was an incident the other day, but I'm not exactly clear on the details. I had just heard that something had happened, but no major incidents to report. Thanksgiving was really successful. As far as I know, everything is generally good.
And we've been receiving the optimistic thoughts.
I'm sorry?
Your name again is?
Oh, sorry, Matt.
Hi, Don said to Rudy, hey, throw me a presser. Rudy said, anything you say, press yes sir. Don said, now. Rudy said, sure. What should I tell him? And Don said, you're gonna go out there with a straight face and tell him I won. And Rudy said, where you want the shilling done? Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son. Don tweeted big event at the Four Seasons. Tweeted then deleted for mysterious reasons. Don said, go. Rudy, he went. Wondering if the president meant Four Seasons, the hotel, or the other one. Between the porno store and the crematorium, Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son.
Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son.
Hey, go out and tell them we got a path. Never mind fairness, never mind math. Election fraud, that's a thing we can fix if we just get the voting out of politics. Go get them, Rudy, while I hide from everyone. Yeah, Fred, consider it done. It's Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son.
Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son.
Rudy, he looked at the places next door. A crematorium and a porno store. As metaphors go, that one's hard to ignore. But somehow he managed and he told the press corps, this race ain't over, people, it's just begun. Press said they called PA Rudy, the race is run. Here at Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son. You're totally hosed, Rudy, pardon the pun. At Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son. Sounds like you're spreading manure. At Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son.
Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son.
And that was Roy Zimmerman doing Four Seasons Total Landscaping. Highway 95 revisited a kind of a takeoff on Bob Dylan's 1965 song. And in case you didn't hear the lyrics, yes, I'm going to give them to you. Don said to Rudy, hey, throw me a presser. Rudy said, anything you say, Prez. Yes, sir. Don said, now. Rudy said, sure. Why should I tell him? And Don said, you're going to go out with a straight face and tell him I won. Now Rudy said, where you want this shilling done? Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son. That's Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son. Don tweeted big event at the Four Seasons. Tweeted, then deleted for mysterious reasons. Don said, go. Rudy, he went, wondering if the president meant Four Seasons, the hotel, or the other one between the porno store and the crematorium. Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son. Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son. Go out and tell them we got a path. Never mind fairness. Never mind math. Election fraud, that's the thing we can fix if we just get the voting out of politics. Go get him, Rudy, while I hide from everyone. Rudy said, yeah, Prez, consider it done. Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son, at Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son. Rudy, he looked at the places next door, crematorium and a porno store. As metaphors go, that's one, that one's hard to ignore. But somehow he managed, and he told the press corps, this race ain't over, people, it's just begun. Press said, they call PA, Rudy, the race is run. It here at Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son. You're totally hosed, Rudy, pardon the pun, at Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son. Sounds like you're spreading manure at Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son. Four Seasons Total Landscaping, son. And here's a story from the Malibu Times from November 27th. RVs and vans rousted from overnight oceanfront parking spots on Pacific Coast Highway. Sheriff's deputies and volunteers on patrol enforce new parking rules along Coral and Zuma beaches by Jimmy Talal, special to Malibu Times. As more and more campers, vans, and RVs begin parking almost bumper to bumper along stretches of Pacific Coast Highway in what seemed like permanent encampments, residents were getting upset. Now notice we're talking about people in houses. The people who are in the vans aren't considered to be residents, even though that may be where they live at the moment. It's a way of separating and making them the other, of course. Continuing, the vehicles not only blocked views, imagine that, and took up free visitor parking, visitors, but posed a public health hazard when it came to trash and septic dumps. And again here, the issue is always, where are the police reports about the big mountains of trash and septic dumps? Why isn't the city and county dealing with this by dealing with these issues, which have to do with the realities of living space and the realities of poverty and the public emergency under COVID-19. Instead, it's why isn't everything being kept in a normal, get those visitors coming through, don't block my view approach. And continuing with this, after nearly 2 years of trying, the city of Malibu finally received approval from Caltrans and the California Coastal Commission to ban overnight parking, this is bad news, along specific areas of Coral and Zuma beaches that had become the biggest problem. The campaign to ban the parking was started by two public safety commissioners, Chris Frost and Doug Stewart. As soon as the approvals were received, the no parking signs went up on Pacific Coast Highway at Coral on Wednesday and at Zuma on Thursday. Nightly enforcement efforts by the L.A. County Sheriff's Department and volunteers on patrol, or VOPs, began at midnight Thursday night, followed by additional enforcement beginning at midnight on Friday. It sounds like they're determined to get these campers out of there. Not to deal with the problem, but to move it somewhere else, or else confiscate people's homes. Stewart was involved in those enforcement efforts and wrote his own account, which he shared with the Malibu Times. And here is, of course, they're quoting his account. Everyone is probably noticing that the RVs and vans that have been homesteading on Coral and Zuma Beach have amazingly disappeared. I was fortunate as a member of the Public Safety Commission to be on a ride-along on Saturday morning to see our new no-parking signs being enforced along Coral and Zuma, as well as strict enforcement of the parking rules on Las Tunas, westward and other places in Malibu. Parking citations and 72-hour red tagging non-moving violators were in full force, the commissioner wrote. It's been a long journey since the Malibu Public Safety Commission requested these new parking restrictions early in 2018. It's kind of ironic for a guy who probably lives in a brick-and-mortar place to talk about a long journey when I guess the only journeying he does is between his home and his office. I don't know the guy, of course. I could be wrong. We could not have done it without the support and assistance of our Public Works Department, Planning Commission, Planning Department, City Council, and the leadership of the city manager, he continued. In other words, all the bullies gang up together. Stewart wrote that the new no-parking regulations for Malibu were modeled after L.A.'s success in getting a similar measure approved to regulate parking along Pacific Coast Highway just east of Mastro's Ocean Club. The first such approval for Malibu was received in early 2020 for the Las Tunas Beach area. With that success, we then moved to a request for Coral and Zuma, Stewart said, which may mean something similar may be coming to Santa Cruz soon, if it's not already here. Since the enforcement efforts began, some of the vehicles have just moved to other areas on Pacific Coast Highway that don't have no parking signs. Even so, many residents expressed gratitude for the city's effort. This is such a relief. I was so gratified to see only three RV-type vehicles instead of 25 yesterday on my way to Thousand Oaks, one wrote on social media. Flippin' yay! Thanks for all your hard work. It is excellent to see the ocean again on the public beaches. However, as one person put it, this is going to be a game of whack-a-mole until even more areas of Pacific Coast Highway are made off-limits for overnight parking. Let's get those Jews out of here. We don't want those low-class gypsies hanging out around our beaches. Those poor people are just messing up our view. And, of course, that's a rather widespread, at least, position from those in power. And that's the Malibu Times story by Jimmy Tallel, RVs and vans rousted from the overnight oceanfront parking spots on Pacific Coast Highway. Notice there's no mention about whether they had any place to go, no counts from any of the people who are in vehicles themselves. It was just all from the point of view of the oppressors. It's a sad situation, but typical. And at about 2:30 this afternoon, I got an email which actually has that timestamp on it from Julie Shaw that mentions their breaking news from Lookout, which is a news service, an online news service in Santa Cruz. No idea how reliable. Regional stay-at-home order to go into effect if the ICU capacity falls below 15%, Newsom says. In the face of a surge on top of a surge, Governor Gavin Newsom announced today the strictest measure in months for a regional stay-at-home order tied to the number of ICU beds as hospitals near their capacity in the face of a statewide coronavirus surge. This new order will be based on the ICU capacity of five different regions in the state, with Santa Cruz County falling in the Bay Area region. Though no region has met the threshold, the governor is warning parts of California could cross the new threshold for mandating people stay within their households as much as possible when a region's ICU capacity drops below 15%. If current trends continue, the Bay Area region can expect to see ICU capacity fall below the 15% capacity threshold by mid to late December, Newsom said, and individual counties could implement their own stricter rules whenever they like, as neighboring Santa Clara County has done. Counties included in the Bay Area region are Alameda, Contra Costa, Marin, Monterey, Napa, San Francisco, San Mateo, Santa Clara, Santa Cruz, Solano, and Sonoma counties. Santa Cruz County currently has 18 out of 37 ICU beds occupied, and half of those patients have COVID-19. This puts the county's ICU capacity at roughly 49% Thursday. But because capacity is assessed regionally and not by county, our numbers have very little to do with the expanded stay-at-home order, given our relatively small size in the overall Bay Area, said county spokesperson Jason Hoppen. And so we'll keep an eye on that. And you'll probably be able to read that in mainstream media. There's a bit more to the story. Under the order, people would have to stay at home. I guess this doesn't have much to do for folks who are living in their tents, although at least it didn't during the March stay-at-home approach or mandate. Although they can still go out for essential things like groceries, exercise, and doctor appointments. K-12 schools that have reopened can remain open, and retail stores can operate indoors at 20% capacity. Bars and restaurants would have to curtail outdoor dining, but will remain open for takeout and delivery. If a region dips under the 15% ICU capacity, the regional order will be triggered within 48 hours, according to the governor's office. Once triggered, the stay-at-home order will be applied for 3 weeks. After that, any reopening of closed services and activities will be based on four-week projections of a region's ICU capacity, suggesting the broad new restrictions could easily last through the end of the year in some communities. Over the last few days, Newsom said the 14-day coronavirus positivity testing rate has gone up from 5.2% to over 7%. Hospitalizations had increased by 86%, and hospitalizations in ICUs around the state had increased by 67%, he said. According to the figures released Thursday, the U.S. logged more than 3,100 COVID-19 deaths in a single day Wednesday, more than 20% higher than the previous record set last spring, when the number of Americans hospitalized with coronavirus eclipsed 100,000 for the first time, and new cases are topping 200,000 a day, the Associated Press reported. The story goes on at greater length. Again, if you want to find it, you can go to Lookout Santa Cruz. But here's a little more, and actually some of these figures, I think, I don't know if they're exactly the same as the figures I was reading in the Sentinel. But here they are in the Lookout. 4,750 known cases in Santa Cruz County of COVID-19. 3,582 known recovered cases, 1,131 known active cases, 37 deaths, 235 required hospitalization, and there's a positivity rate of 8.2%. But not mentioned in this Lookout story, but mentioned in the Sentinel's by the numbers little sidebar in its story about a nursing home surges, is that the negative tests were 75,865 compared with the total number of positive tests, 4,695. So that means there are, boy, 20 times as many negative tests as there are positive. Of course, there's problems with that because you don't know if somebody has it or not. You don't know if it's in a transmittable stage because the symptoms are not there, as I'm sure everybody out there has been following this at all knows. And finally, the story concludes, although I'm skipping parts of it, if triggered, the businesses that will remain open under a regional stay-at-home order are schools that are already open, critical infrastructure, retail at 20% capacity to reduce exposure, and restaurants for takeout and delivery. Those will be temporarily closed until, of course, they go out of business or so forth. Bars, wineries, personal services, hair salons, and barber shops. It's not clear to me for those who are concerned about more extensive shutdowns now to avoid more illness later, why schools that are already open would not be closed as well. But the governor apparently just proceeds with these edicts. We don't have a legislature sitting that takes any action on this. And I believe there are lawsuits in the courts that have been challenging restrictions on gathering for places like churches. As those following this may know, the Supreme Court did rule, although it didn't have an immediate impact on the New York case because New York had already loosened its restrictions on assemblies and churches, that churches can't be more restricted than other mass assembly type places like airports and other places of transit. If you want to hear Governor Newsom, or Gruesome Newsom as I call him, his press conference, you can also find a link to that in the sign-in website at the Lookout website, Lookout Santa Cruz, and there you are. So on Monday, November 25th, there was a protest in front of volunteer police officer Deb Elston's house. She's the one who is sort of the lead officer that has recently been citing, ticketing, and warning Alicia Cole, where she's parked with her vehicle. Alicia says quite legally, moving it regularly to accord with the 72-hour storage law. You can't be in a place for more than 72 hours, a state law. But nonetheless, finding herself harassed, and she and others came to do a nighttime, early nighttime, it was early in the evening, started at 6 and I think it ended at 8, protest in front of Elston's west side house next to a lake. And here's some of the colloquy that happened. I played some of it already in a prior show. Here's a little more. Deborah never came out and took the invitation to be enter into a discussion about what her motivations were, what her response was to the concerns people had, that people were being forced out of their vehicles with this kind of intense pressure on them, and also false reporting of the, by their accounts anyway, of vehicles being there for more than 72 hours. She chose not to come out if she was there at all. Some say she was. I couldn't tell myself. Instead, some man came out of the house concerned when as the protesters were near his, or I guess a car that he was concerned about that was parked there, perhaps his car, and there was an exchange of, well, here's the exchange that happened.
We're standing in front of Deborah Elston's house. Would you like to take away homeless people's vehicles and write them tickets and hope that they'll lose their vehicles in the middle of winter and the pandemic?
She
also feels it's okay to run people over in her police service vehicle. Well,
so what happened was Deborah Elston is a police volunteer.
Oh, she's coming out, guys.
She wrote about $400 worth of
tickets
to Alicia.
Good evening.
Along with other police volunteers. And one of the individuals, Josh, who's here, was...
And actually, she wasn't coming out. That was, as I said, this other individual. He didn't identify who he was. And the voice you hear explaining this is one of the demonstrators describing it to one of the folks walking by, one of the passers-by. People walked by walking their dogs on their bikes and so forth in the neighborhood in the usual sort of course of evening business or evening, a typical residential neighborhood.
Standing in front of her car while she was writing tickets, taking pictures, and as she drove away, she hit him with her car, and
that's
then continued
okay.
to drive. And
well,
then
I'm
he called the police.
You're on the street.
And this was a key concern of the protesters, that Elston, first of all, hit Josh, a man who was with Alicia and the group of people that were at Alicia's car, as he tried to take photos of her volunteer police vehicle and the police people who were, or the alleged volunteer police people who were either putting stickers on cars or making about to do so. And their vehicle then, according to his account, hit him. And he demanded they wait until he could file a police report about them, which the police eventually refused to take, instead charging him with false imprisonment for not letting the volunteer police vehicle go until the police arrived.
What about the people's cars that you kick people out? Oh, yeah, she did. Yeah, well, bullshit to you and go fuck yourself, homie. This will happen.
You're concerned about your property?
Hey,
what about people's lives?
I'm Josh May, and I am the one she hit with the car.
What about people's lives?
She is going to lose her fucking job, homie. Get it right.
Who came out of the house is concerned with that people step away from his car, as you heard, but no one was threatening his car. People are just standing around the vehicle.
Same on Deborah Elston.
Stop running on our cars. Stop running on our cars. Leave our cars alone. Leave our cars alone. Stop bothering us.
Leave
our cars alone. Stop bothering people. Leave people alone.
Stop bothering people. What goes around comes around.
Quit your job.
Quit
your job.
I don't think she actually has a job. She's a volunteer.
Quit your volunteer.
Leave people alone. Leave people alone.
Blair?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Quit your job.
And at a certain point, I walked up the street to the adjacent house and eventually began a conversation with a man who had come out to hear what was going on and see what was happening.
Quit your job.
Quit your job.
Quit your job.
You should.
Walking up the street to offer some literature to anybody who wants it. Evening.
And that kind of winds it up for this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. There is a longer edition which you can find online, which involves an interview with one of Deb Elston's neighbors. He did not want this to be netcast, so I'm not going to netcast it. But if you want to hear it, I did advise him it was going to be archived, and he seemed to have no objection to that. So if you want to hear the rest of this Bathrop Spears Broadsides as an archive, go to the Huff website at huffsantacruz.org and look for it under the date December 3rd under Latest and Lost Shows, and you will find it there. Back at you again on Sunday, and we'll be, talking at you then. And coming up next on the stream of free radio at freakradio.org, as I always say, is Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the December 3rd, 2020 show, the short show, but I think it's pretty packed. We have a review of a Santa Monica lawsuit that is being undertaken on behalf of homeless folks whose homes are their vehicles down there. We're going to visit the Food Not Bombs meal again. That's one of our usual stops. Yesterday there, interviewed a number of people, including Cooper of the Freedom Camp, as they camp next to the lawn bowling area, right near the county building is called, what with the Benchlands camp having moved. And we're also going to look in on some interviews at the Huff meeting that we did also yesterday, which is open to the public. You're invited to come. All you got to do is mask up and chow down. We do a little feeding there as well, although we're not Food Not Bombs. We provide usually veggies and coffee and stimulating conversation and hopes of future actions to restore civil rights to homeless folks in Santa Cruz. Here's the show.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's begin with a commercial for the annual Homelessness Marathon, which is coming up.
The Homelessness Marathon is America's only national radio broadcast focusing on homelessness and poverty. The Homelessness Marathon will air on Wednesday, December 9th.
I wish they would do something about getting people off the streets.
I'm not giving up, and I don't want nobody to feel sorry for me.
The 22nd Annual Homelessness Marathon will air on Wednesday, December 9th, right here on this radio station.
So hopefully we will be running the Homelessness Marathon coming up next Wednesday. It's shorter than usual, and it's being done not out of a particular city, as is usually the case, but it's being done from different places around the country because people are either sheltering in place or staying home for one reason or another. The PR release given by Jeremy Alderson, who runs the marathon and has done it for 22 years, says a few things. I'll read what he's written me. The pandemic may have made it harder to do the broadcast, but it also made it more necessary. More than ever before, the lives of homeless people are in danger, and more than ever before, housed people are in danger of becoming homeless. Homelessness Marathon is America's only national broadcast focusing on homelessness and poverty. It's dedicated to creating a national dialogue by bringing the voices of America's homeless into America's homes. I have no idea how successful, by the way, that it's been, though I've been a participant for many of those broadcasts, either as one who simply passes it on through free radio, or actually on one occasion I went to Detroit and did, I think another one of their broadcasts, went to another place, Fresno as well, when they came to Fresno, and we did it out of there. But again, I can't say whether this actually produces much result, and that's always a question I'm asking regarding our HUF work, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, or usually just meet with and talk with. I don't know, work is a, I don't know, we chow down, chat, and chomp is kind of what we do every Wednesday at 11 at the Sub Rosa, but I can't say what the impact has been. Although I've generated a lot of flyers, paper, and online announcements over the years, and you can look back on that if you want to get a sense of the history of some of the activism in Santa Cruz around homelessness. And check out the 22nd Homelessness Marathon. I'm hoping it's going to be available. You can probably get it from other nonprofit stations. And I'm hoping it'll be broadcast here. I can't guarantee it, and I'll be making a clearer announcement about that, I think, on Sunday, after I get in touch with the lone techie who is still with Free Radio and see how that can be done. And while I'm at it, an announcement about the December Street Spirit newspaper, for those of you who probably far or few and far between but still around, who read that newspaper, which usually carries stories about Berkeley, San Francisco, Oakland, and sometimes other cities as well. It's a little bit shrunken and kind of special interest to some homeless, I don't want to necessarily call them poverty pimps, that may be unkind and unfair, but it doesn't have the breadth and the depth and the bulk that it had under previous editor Terry Messman. But you can still get it. You can still sell it if you're poor or homeless and you want to do that. You can find it by coming to the HUF meetings on Wednesday at 11 at the Sub Rosa, as mentioned before. That's at 703 Pacific next to the Bike Church. Or you can call me on the HUF phone line at 423-HUF, 423-HUFF. Or the long number is 831-423-4833, and I'll get you copies one way or another. And sometimes we leave those copies actually kind of regularly at Food Not Bombs. I also try to, if I can, get copies of Street Sheet as well as Street Spirit. That's the Coalition on Homelessness's paper. Comes out twice a month in out of San Francisco's Coalition on Homelessness. It's still nitty-gritty, as it has always been throughout its 20 years, actually 30 years now, Street Spirit out in, from coming from the heart of the Tenderloin in San Francisco. And I occasionally am able to bring it down and make it available for distribution as well. You can write for Street Spirit or Street Sheet. I don't think you're going to get any money for it, but you might be able to pass on the word about what's going on in Santa Cruz to these two papers, and they may print what you do. So get in touch with me if you're interested in being a writer, 423-4833, or you can try to contact them directly, but I may be helpful in assisting you with that. And I'm not sure this is actually going to happen, because these things tend to pile up. Coming up next Tuesday is another shitty council meeting, or Santa Cruz City Council meeting, if you want to be accurate. They are likely to be swearing in their new members. They have two new members. One of them is a downtown association boss, and I don't really have a lot to say about the other one. I have not been terribly interested, but there are two new council members coming on. Sandy Brown and Watkins, the former mayor, will be returning as part of the very reactionary majority, at least in the part of Watkins, who sort of led the dare I say, racist, classist city council meeting of last year, which dumped the only council members really interested in dealing with homeless issues. I suppose Sandy Brown is too, but it's a mixed bag for Sandy. She, I think she's, you might call her, from her perspective, pragmatic. From my perspective, well, she's lied to me, and she's broken her word, and I don't forgive that in a politician unless they make some attempt to acknowledge it, apologize for it, and stop doing it. And Sandy, at least in my case, has not done that. So I'm still hoping, well, I'm not hoping at all, but that's still an open option for her. And I've talked about it on past shows, and we'll talk about it again probably as time goes on. But Sandy's also done some good votes. She has to be given credit for that. But not for other things, which weigh pretty heavily on the ledger as I look at them. But in any case, the council meeting is coming up, and I wanted to review the detailed proposals that were rubber stamped, it appeared to me, by Andy Mills, that were rubber stamped by the council after being presented by the police chief Mills at the last city council, by actually having a discussion with, or at least reading some of the commentary of people who are critical of it, like Lee Brockow of the ACLU, John Malkin, a former member of the Citizens Police Review Board, and part of a group trying to establish a more powerful Citizens Review Board many years ago. Not that I'm any fan of these Citizen Review Boards anymore, but at the time it was it seemed to many of us a meaningful step, if only it had gotten some teeth, and if the teeth it had gotten were actually been used to chomp down on police abuse, and neither things really happened. But I'm hoping I'll be able to give you at least a very brief look over about what the City Council has coming up on its agenda. That's behind closed doors, pretty much zooming along with public comment type time cut short by Mayor Justin Cummings. Our very own Uncle Tom of Santa Cruz, who poses as someone who's concerned about police abuse and civil rights for poor people, which is, I guess he doesn't really pose that much. It's not really fair to say that. But some people so regard him, and that's probably because he's sort of the tattered remains of the progressive majority that we thought we had in 2018 before he deserted it very soon in January 2019, on the key issues of rent control and homelessness. So some listeners may remember interviews I've had with Santa Barbara writer and activist Peter Marin, who's kind of sort of stepped down, he's in his 80s now, and trying to, probably do other things. He writes a lot of poetry about death and subjects of that sort, profound subjects. But he's also covers what's going on, and I think with some clarity and sharpness, when I can get him on the line, which sometimes takes a little doing, but it happens. And he has talked about a lawsuit that is now has been filed in Santa Barbara. It's the Committee for Social Justice. And then a number of other plaintiffs, Linda Trevino, Bradley Beach, Patricia West, Larry Carver, Richard Paluk, Alan Schwab, Arthur Lopez, Andrew Navarez, Thomas Goodwin, and Judy Atkins, none of whom I know, by the way, versus the City of Santa Barbara, the City of Santa Barbara Police Department, and the City of Santa Barbara Police Chief, Lori Lunau, don't know her either, and Does 1 through 20. And here is a bit of this lawsuit, as it reads, introduction. In the midst of a severe housing crisis characterized by dramatically rising rents, shrinking affordable housing supply, long waits for housing subsidies, and a homeless population that has grown dramatically in the last 18 years, the City of Santa Barbara is targeting its most vulnerable residents, the homeless. There exist a large number of unsheltered homeless residents in Santa Barbara, many with disabilities who seek shelter in recreational vehicles, RVs, or other vehicles. For these people, their vehicles are their only reliable, safe shelter from the elements and only place to store their belongings. Despite this, the city decided that those living in their RVs created a significant public nuisance due to sanitation, littering, excessive noise, placement by RV owners of personal belongings outside of RVs, and illegal dumping. Does this sound familiar, folks? These are some of the similar pretexts that have been used to drive away Alicia Cool and others from the spot where they were camping cleanly and safely along Olive Street off of Mission some months ago. In order to restrict RV parking, the lawsuit continues, the city adopted ordinances to restrict RV parking on certain streets and at certain time periods, eventually prohibiting RV parking completely on any street in Santa Barbara. This was tried at night in Santa Cruz, which we were able to successfully fight by taking it to the Coastal Commission. It's not clear to me why this hasn't been done in Santa Barbara. It may have been explained to me one time or another, but I'm not sure what the explanation was. Maybe I can bring it up again and see what either Peter Marin or the person who's taking over that kind of work, and he's suggested some people that I could call attorneys who are doing this lawsuit, people with this Committee for Social Justice that he's been working with in Santa Barbara. So let's hope that happens in the future. This prohibition forced the homeless RV dwellers in Santa Barbara to park their RV in specific locations designated by the city for both day and night parking, or pay $48 for every offense parking on a city street. You have something similar happening in Santa Cruz with the Association of Faith Communities programs and other programs that call themselves safe parking programs, but at least for some RV people, are not safe at all. They aren't usable. They don't allow adequate access. They don't provide adequate support. I'm still trying to get sort of to the bottom of this in terms of claims and counterclaims, and some of them you probably have heard in the interviews I've done on the show, but if anybody wants to do research around the RV situation, I'm definitely interested in backing you up. I'm at 423-4833. Give me a call and we'll talk. Again, back to Santa Barbara. For RV dwellers living on a very limited disability or retirement income, payment of each $48 fine results in a severe reduction in available cash for living expenses such as food, gas, clothing, and vehicle insurance. And, of course, that's true in Santa Cruz, too. The city's pattern of passing ordinances targeting homeless RVs started on November 19, 2002, when the city adopted Ordinance 5263 to prohibit overnight parking from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. Now, in Santa Cruz, what we have instead of the parking prohibitions, we have sort of piecemeal prohibitions that have spread through so-called permit parking, which forces you to park for only 2 hours unless you get a permit, and you can't get a permit unless you are a brick-and-mortar resident. Alternately, people can't park in the city's public parking lots anymore at night. That's become illegal, even though those lots are empty, and there's no reason people shouldn't be parking there. You'll hear pretexts about, sanitation, where are they going to go poo? Have you heard of such a thing as a porta-potty or possibly opening some of the bathrooms at night? These obvious things, which became even more crucial with the COVID-19 crisis, they didn't entirely elude the city authorities. City authorities put in more porta-potties suddenly, perhaps alarmed that people around town are going to get sick as a consequence of the failure to provide adequate sanitation for both visitors and homeless people outside, as well as residents who are, abroad during the day or at night for one reason or another. And this is going to be a situation that grows more difficult and more severe, I think, as the COVID-19 surge increases. I mean, we have not just positive COVID tests increasing, which is significant, although people who are skeptical of the COVID crisis will tell you, look at how many people recovered. There's huge numbers of recovery, and the increase in the number of positive tests may be a function of more people getting tested, which is probably true to some extent. And the fact is, you know, there is a growing likelihood of a vaccine. If you're a vaccine fan, although many people who are skeptical of the COVID-19 situation are also skeptical of vaccines. And I think we have had, I don't know if we had have had many people recently on this. I'm still trying, but not very hard, to get together a debate with folks who are in this minority. It's a minority in Santa Cruz. I wouldn't call it a minority nationwide, though. I'd say there's a lot of people who voted for Trump more than last election. Yes, Trump got more votes, and he did better in almost every segment of the population except
Ladies and children, do not be alarmed. The sounds you hear tonight are the sweet, sexy sounds of your soul being ripped apart. This is Lost at Sea, your off-freeway of Santa Cruz 101.3 FM. I am your host, as always, Barry Sutherland. Or should I be Scary Sutherland? Happy Halloween, people. That's right. As you listen to this episode, it is Halloween. We're on near the end of it. We're at the end of Halloween. Hope your trick-or-treating was good. And for all those tricks out there treating people, hope you wore a condom. Yeah, safe sex is all about social distancing. From P into V. Yeah. I hope these tones tonight soothe the skeletons inside your bones and the bones inside your skeletons. I hope the music you hear tonight will curdle your blood so it looks like cottage cheese in a warm summer sun left out for 5 days. I hope this now turns your hair white on your head, but also makes your testicle hair look green. Tonight, Santa Cruz, your souls are mine. Sports.
I'm looking forward to your arrival on Halloween night. I hope you will bring me lots of presents.
Who are you writing to, Reyes?
This is the time of year to write to the Great Pumpkin. On Halloween night, the Great Pumpkin rises out of his pumpkin patch and flies through the air with his bag of toys for all the children.
You must be crazy. When are you going to stop believing in something that isn't true?
When you stop believing in that fellow with the red suit and the white beard who goes, ho, ho, ho.
We are obviously separated by denominational differences.
You must get discouraged because more people believe in Santa Claus than you. Well, let's face it, Santa Claus has had more publicity. But being number two, perhaps you try harder.
D-O-G-G-O-D!